Hi, folks. You're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Hey, why haven't you become a member yet? I know you want to. Last week, you said, I'm going to become a member this week, and then you forgot. Well, you know what? Now is the time to do it. We need your support. And when you become a member, you get not only get 2 more hours of commercial-free radio program, Ring of Fire Radio, you also get access to a decade's worth of archives, maybe more. Thousands of shows, amazing guests. Check it out. I know you're going to like it. We need your support. Ring of Fire Radio survives because of its members. And you can become a member at ROFpodcast.com. ROFpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Esquire Magazine's Charlie Pierce will explain why Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer doesn't understand the concept of leverage, nor is he in any sense the wartime consigliere when it comes to the latest bipartisan budget deal. Anne Clothier from No Olympics LA will join us to discuss why her organization's goal is to stop the 2028 Olympics being hosted in the city of Los Angeles. Daniel Aldana Cohen from the University of Pennsylvania will explain how we tackle the climate and housing crisis with a Green New Deal for housing. And Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to analyze all the news from this week. Hey, if you're listening to the radio show right now, you should know that there's a free 1 hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever your podcasts are found. There is also a member show. You get our 3 hour radio show commercial free. Access to 10 years of our archives, and you will support this program. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Helping me run down another busy week in news, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, a lot to talk about, obviously, in terms of the second debate of the Democrats, the first and second versions of the second debate. Let's save that for the last hour of the program, because we have a lot to talk about in terms of two major topics, one being, and they're interrelated, although they may not sound that way. One is that we have, in the wake of the Mueller report, a cascade of Democrats signing on to impeachment, although I think as of now we're somewhere at least over 10% more Democrats, and we're very close to a half of the Democratic caucus in the House and a couple of major Democrats in the Senate signing on to impeachment. Simultaneously, we also have the appointment of a new or a would-be new head of the director of National Intelligence, this guy Ratcliffe. And in my mind, and we can take the second first, in my mind, these two are related because Ratcliffe brings with him not so much experience in the intelligence world, in fact, a complete absence of which, but he does bring with him a narrative. And I'm quite convinced that in the absence of a Democratic impeachment, never mind getting Donald Trump out of office or not, just an inquiry and a full-on movement towards impeachment. In the absence of this, I have a feeling the person we're going to be talking about constantly is this guy Ratcliffe, because he's the one who's coming to the White House with a narrative that I think the Republicans are going to pursue.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we talked about this, you know, right after the Mueller report was released and worried about this, that, you know, the vacuum that was being created on the Democratic side by failing to immediately launch into, you know, a flurry of hearings and just sort of jumping on it, that this was going to be filled by the right wing's counter narrative, which they've been building for a long time. Ratcliffe has been part of this from the beginning. As a member of the House Intelligence Committee, he's an accomplice of Devin Nunes, the former chairman and now ranking member, who pursued a number of, I mean, they were dead ends in reality, but on the right wing, you know, in terms of right wing propaganda, they are the counter narrative to, quote, what really happened. And what really happened in their view is that there was a cabal of maybe not even a cabal, a full institutional commitment to taking down Donald Trump before the election. And so they ginned up this Russia interference story, and they ginned up the idea that Donald Trump was benefiting from it. And basically, it's a series of setups to make Donald Trump look bad. And, you know, the illogic of that is obvious. I mean, if they, you know, you'd think they would have said something before the election, if they were trying to do that,
right,
to try and sabotage Donald Trump. Instead, they sabotaged Hillary Clinton. But nonetheless, this has strong, strong currency in right-wing circles and certainly in the White House. And so this idea, you know, they got William Barr, who, you know, at first they were going to put in a toady, you know, Matt Whitaker. And I think that Trump did have the intention of making him the attorney general, and that was sort of rejected by the Republicans, going, wait a minute, you know, we need somebody with a tiny bit more legitimacy than this guy. And they found William Barr, who is perfect, because he is not only a guy that everybody in Washington and the press corps, oh, he's an institutionalist, he'll do, you know, he's honest, he's a good man, he worked for George Bush Sr., et cetera, et cetera. Well, he has turned out to be Trump's number one henchman, and he is promoting this alternative version of events from within the Justice Department. Ratcliffe. Him being part of this in the House, and if he is put in as the head of the intelligence agency, what will have happened is that Trump will then have, at the top level of the Department of Justice and the intelligence community, in charge of 17 different intelligence agencies, people who are devoted to his protection and devoted to proving this alternate theory of the case, and potentially, and I think this is what's most relevant to us at this moment, potentially ensuring that whatever happens with the upcoming election, that the U.S. government will not interfere in any attempts to, let's say, help Donald Trump win election again from foreign or domestic sources. This is where law enforcement and, you know, this is where they deal with campaign finance, law enforcement, and intelligence. And so what you're seeing is, I mean, this is a very, very frightening development. You have, and everybody's going, well, he won't get the right intelligence anymore, and Ratcliffe won't tell him the truth and everything. That's not the point. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't care what the intelligence is, right? He believes what he wants to believe, no matter what they tell him. The problem is that he will have somebody in there who is devoted to protecting Donald Trump above all else. And that is what we're now looking at, a situation. Trump said just this week that he was putting Ratcliffe in there because he was going to, he didn't use the word purge. He said they, you know, they've run amok, and he's gonna put a stop to that. In the intelligence community has run amok, and we know that, and he's gonna put a stop to it. So I think we know what the agenda is here, and it's not good. This is the hallmark of an authoritarian government.
It's incredibly dangerous, and so give me your sense of whether this is someone who is going to pass muster. I mean, we have someone here who is now on record of, I mean, you know, the news is reporting it as he misrepresented his role in an anti-terror case. It appears that he just completely lied about his role in an anti-terror case back in 2015. We have, like you say, he is one of the people who started the sort of the the secret cabal and the FBI narrative here. What is your sense as if this is somebody who can get passed through the Senate? Because my guess is that, you know, this is one that Donald Trump wants. He saw this guy up there trying to throw up smoke and dirt, you know, during the Mueller hearings. And Donald Trump knows that the intelligence community probably has a lot more information than Mueller had, and that the investigation there seems more robust, frankly, than what Mueller did. So what is your sense of whether any of the Republicans will really care about the director of national intelligence having absolutely no bona fides? And while I imagine being a director of national intelligence, it helps to lie, be able to lie. This guy's not lying about the right stuff. But let's wait for the answer to that question, Heather, when we come back on the other side. I'm Sam Cedar, Ring Fire Radio. We'll be right back. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were talking about Donald Trump's pick for National Intelligence Director, this guy Ratcliffe. He was the he's a congressman from, I believe it's Texas. He is the was the one of the guys who was auditioning, I guess, during the Mueller hearings for this position. With Donald Trump by showing that he could spin a web of how the intelligence agencies are really out to get Donald Trump and that this is all made up. But here's my question to you. With all of this knowledge that Ratcliffe has lied about his role in past terror cases when he was an attorney, he has basically come up with this fanciful notion that is maybe QAnon adjacent almost in terms of a counter narrative. What are the chances that the Republicans in the Senate will say this is just a bridge too far? Is it zero or just slightly above zero?
Well, that's a perfect way of putting it. You know, this is kind of interesting because apparently Richard Burr, who is the head of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, a Republican who, you know, he's no hero, but he isn't quite, he's maybe just a tiny bit above zero in terms of integrity on the Republican side. He apparently was asked about Ratcliffe a week or so ago. Remember, we read that Trump had asked Devin Nunes up to the White House to talk about who he should choose, and everybody was going, oh my God, he's going to pick Nunes. Well, apparently Nunes said, nah, you know, Ratcliffe's your guy, and then Ratcliffe performed well in the Mueller hearing, and, you know, Trump was sold. Burr apparently was not high on that and said that it, you know, and by statute, by the way, this person is supposed to have a lot of experience. This is not a role that anyone anticipated as a political role. They really did not. They assumed that this would be a person that would have the kind of breadth of experience, certainly intelligence experience at some point in their careers. And Ratcliffe's really all it is 6 months on the House Intelligence Committee. committee. That's it. That's the rest of it, as far as him being a terrorist prosecutor and all that, just appears to be a resume embellishment, to say the least. So in any case, Burr apparently said, no, you need to pick somebody who's not going to have a partisan profile if you want to have intelligence be taken seriously by anybody, and not just here in the United States, but around the world. I mean, imagine how our allies are going to look at this. I mean, they can't trust American intelligence when you have a partisan toady in charge of all of it. So there is some pushback, and you can kind of sense it. Nobody's coming right out and saying it, but, there is some pushback. But I don't know, Sam. I kind of agree with you that this is one Trump really cares about. It was one thing in the DOJ. They went through this with Whitaker, as I mentioned, that, I think Trump wanted him, but he didn't have any real... I mean, Whitaker was just a nice guy that, kind of hung out in the White House as Jeff Sessions' mole, basically, and Trump liked him. But I don't think he had an investment in anything that Whitaker was doing. But Ratcliffe, this guy is he's one of the architects of this counter-narrative that I think is extremely important to Trump. And I think he wants somebody in that job that is going to do that thing, that's going to purge the intelligence agencies. I mean, it just seems obvious to me that that's what this is about, with the goal of protecting Trump and theoretically also ensuring that, this next election goes the way that he wants it to. And I think that Ratcliffe, may be one that really ends up being a test for the Republicans in the Senate. And, do we have any reason to believe that they won't end up going along with it? I mean, I have no. I mean, I guess Susan Collins has expressed concerns, as usual.
Right.
What are they? Is anybody going to stand up on this? I mean, maybe.
No. No,
but
no.
I doubt it.
I mean, I think we also got another hint as to the incentive structure of the Republicans in terms of, it could very well be that he wants Ratcliffe in there because he feels he'll protect him for what the intelligence agency knows about the past. But we know that Dan Coats quit because he felt that his warnings about Russian interference in the election were unheeded, not just the 2016, but going forward, even in the 2018 election, he said they won't have that problem with Ratcliffe. He will be the one who squelches those. We know that Mitch McConnell would not allow for even a vote on some Senate bills that would have dealt with some of the insecurities in the data files of various states and cities and towns in terms of voting. I mean, I think there is a real, out in the open, explicit lack of will, almost a deliberate lack of will, to secure the election. Now, we're not talking about in terms of, Facebook posts, and I have no idea whether Facebook posts would have, in any way affected the outcome of the 2016 election. I have no idea that anybody cares about what you and I say or any of our work on any given day, right? I mean, it's always possible. But what is clear is that according to these intelligence agencies, the Russians, and I would be just as disturbed if it was, the Koch brothers or Boeing or whomever, frankly, or I don't know, some Democratic operatives had basically breached the firewalls and were able to manipulate. They didn't do so, but they basically were in a position where they could manipulate voter rolls. And of course, we know how that implicates the outcomes of elections. When you can knock off voters off the rolls in certain areas, you know who you're knocking off. You get a pretty good yield on Democrats over, Republicans, and then it's off to the races. So this is a real, real problem, and one I'm sure we're going to be discussing in the future. But in the meantime, we're going to take a break. See you in the next hour, Digby. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, Esquire Magazine's Charlie Pierce on the latest bipartisan budget deal debacle. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. When we recorded this interview earlier in the week, a bipartisan budget deal was inching its way to the Senate floor on Wednesday. The budget plan, as is, would severely hamper a Democratic president if one is fortunately elected in 2020. Here to explain why Chuck Schumer has failed to use any form of leverage, Charlie Pierce from Esquire Magazine. So, Charlie, let's just start with what the deal that has been made. I don't think Trump has signed it yet, but he supposedly will, right?
That's what he says now, but who knows?
Right. That's subject to change at any minute, particularly depending on what they're talking about on Fox and Friends that morning.
I was about to say, if Fox and Friends people wake up some morning and decide it's a terrible deal, the whole thing will change.
But that's also a function of whether Sean Hannity sends word downstairs or whatever it is. So there's a lot of contingencies.
Go ahead.
So, all right, well, tell us what's in this bipartisan budget deal.
Well, I mean, to me, it's kind of a sucker play. I mean, it takes, you know, whole debt ceiling. There is an increase in spending. There is some sugar there for Democrats of all persuasions. But it takes the debt ceiling thing away as a hostage for a couple of years. But the whole deal comes back at exactly the wrong time in 2021. It comes back just in time to hamstring the next president if it's Democrat.
So, in other words, we have the debt ceiling, right, that's looming. And people, just
right.
to remind people.
We should get rid of the debt ceiling, by the way,
right.
But that's another discussion.
Well, but maybe it isn't, because maybe that's part of the point. In terms of what that would have been a give or a get, we should just remind people that the debt ceiling is basically a pro forma move to say that the money that we've appropriated in the budget deal, we're actually going to pay. And we realize we have to borrow more money to do it. So we need to raise the debt ceiling. Before we talk about the deal that Chuck Schumer struck this time, do you remember back in, I think it was, now I'm trying to get my dates right, it was in 2016, the Republicans, maybe it was 2017, I can't even remember now, the Republicans were facing another debt ceiling,
There was all sorts of things that were going to come to the fore that the Republicans were going to have to deal with. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer went into the president's office sometime around August, late August, early September. The Republicans were really looking at like a half a dozen things that were about to crash on the shore, essentially, you know, from September to December. People were wondering whether they could handle it all. Donald Trump said, "I love children. I definitely want to deal with DACA." Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer apparently took him at face value. And they basically took all of the things, basically the debt ceiling and the budget, off the table. So the Republicans didn't have to deal with it
right.
At a time when the Trump administration was complete disarray. I feel like we're seeing that again.
See, I understand that, you know, somebody has to make decisions by which the country gets governed. OK, whether that's the president who's supposed to do it, but doesn't know anything about anything, which kind of hamstrings you if you're trying to run a government. The Democrats continually step into this role as national hall monitor, you know, and they never get any credit for it. They always get blamed for it. And it always lets the Republicans off the hook.
Well, in this
I guarantee you by the middle of the campaign, there'll be an entire series of independent expenditure ads about the dangers of the debt and deficit. And those will be put together largely to keep any possible Democratic president from governing fully like a Democrat.
Okay, to be clear, this deal, this budget deal, it gets some spending that the Democrats want, but it basically punts the question of the debt ceiling, which has been often held hostage by Republicans. Democrats and Republicans over the years have sort of basically said, maybe taken like a symbolic vote against it just because they are deficit hawks or, you know, debt scourges or whatever. And that's very performative. But there's been some time in the past where Republicans really threatened to actually prevent the debt ceiling from being lifted, in which case we would default on our debt obligations because we wouldn't be allowed to pay a single dollar to anybody.
Right.
And who knows what would happen in that instance, because we've never done it in the history of the country. So Chuck Schumer made a deal where there will not be, the debt ceiling will be raised automatically for the next 2 years, like you say, landing in the lap of the next president, who could presumably be a Democrat, hopefully, right? If that's like you plan for success.
Well, yeah, I mean, because if it turns out to be Donald Trump, he's just going to ignore the deal.
Exactly. It doesn't matter at that point what the deal is. It is predicated. It has to be predicated on the idea that Donald Trump won't be there, at least from the Democratic perspective. But if that's the case, then here's the real question. I mean, this is the central question. Is Chuck Schumer just an idiot, or does he? No, I'm not being silly here. Is Chuck Schumer just an idiot who doesn't realize that this is going to fall amongst a Democratic president? I can't imagine that you would find any living human being who has been following politics for the past 5 or 10 years, never mind sitting in the Senate, who's not aware that the Republicans are simply going to play the exact same games they've played with the debt ceiling in the past. Like, I mean, no one could not know that unless they were a total idiot. So my question is Chuck Schumer a total idiot, or is he purposefully trying to handcuff the next Democratic president so that Republicans have some leverage if the next Democratic president is like, I'm going to roll back the tax cuts or whatever it is? Is he purposely giving Republicans leverage? Because that's the effect of it. So I don't if you have an option C, I'm happy to include that in the question. But as far as I can tell, there's two options: idiot or specifically trying to give the Republicans leverage to stymie a Democratic president in 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it basically what you're asking is he stupid or a mole? Basically, well, I mean, you know, his primary constituent. I mean, we shouldn't lose track of the fact that his primary constituents are the large banks and the large financial institutions in New York, who I'm sure are scared to death at the fact that people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and, you know, frankly, a whole chunk of the Democratic field are starting to get a little traction on the idea that breaking the money power in politics and breaking the monopoly power and money are both pretty good ideas. And I don't know. I mean, honestly, I honestly don't know. I know Chuck Schumer is not too stupid to read a calendar, okay?
Right.
I mean, he knows what happens in January of 2021.
I mean, I don't see any other answer. And it's not so much that he's a mole. It's just that his politics may be such that he does not want a Democratic president to come in there with a big tax reinstituting or a big spending agenda. And the way to curb that is not Chuck Schumer standing up and saying, hey, I know I'm a Democrat, but I want to keep you from doing this stuff that the vast majority of Democrats want you to do. The best way to do that is to basically say, I'm not doing anything. Maybe I made a mistake 2 years ago when I handed the Republicans the keys to the Maserati, essentially, and said,
"Well,
go ahead."
If you have two major political parties, okay, and we're going to have only two major political parties for the foreseeable future, until we change the way we run elections, which we aren't going to do. One of them, you can't have one that's completely extreme and another one that isn't. We can't have one that's completely extreme and one that's afraid to be. I mean, even if you're not extreme, you should threaten to be. You should have some credibility of threatening to be, so you get at least 80% of what you want.
Yep.
They can't. I mean, I don't think that the Chuck Schumer part of the Democratic Party can credibly threaten anything that scares the Republicans anymore.
I totally agree with
you.
Hold on, let's take a break. Hold that thought. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to hear more of this because we need to talk about Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And really, I think, you know, there needs to be a real a questioning of their leadership and what their agenda is, because unless you talk about the things that we're talking about, I just don't know what the answer is. But we got to take a quick break. I'll be right back with the great Charlie Pierce in just a moment.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Esquire Magazine's Charlie Pierce about his piece, Chuck Schumer is Not a Wartime Consigliere. So, Charlie, in the last segment, I posed a question to you that I don't know. I think it was a fair question, but maybe you thought, maybe, I don't know. Is Chuck Schumer an idiot, or is he specifically trying to handcuff the next Democratic president by negotiating with Donald Trump and saying, we're going to punt. You're not going to have to deal with the debt ceiling from your lunatic base for 2 years or from getting leverage from us. And we're just going to make the next president, presumably this will be, I don't know, President Democrat, hopefully, in 2020, 2021, deal with the debt ceiling again. I mean, it's handing the Republicans all this leverage. And for the life of me, let me put it a different way. Not is he stupid or is he handing them leverage purposefully. Let me put a different question to you. Is he a bad tactician? Or is he actually a good tactician? Like, well, do we know what
the outcome to be?
Well, exactly. I mean, so I don't know if we know what he wants the outcome to be, but what would you imagine it would be based upon what he's doing?
I think he's a bad tactician. I do not believe he is a wartime consigliere, as they say in the movie. I think he's ill-equipped both in terms of personality and in terms of, as we talked about earlier, who his real political constituency is to take on what needs to be taken on, which is basically the fact that Mitch McConnell has given up on governing except on behalf of a very thin slice of the population, and maybe really not on behalf of them either. I mean, at some point you have to decide that there is absolutely no good faith on the other side, and there is absolutely no good faith on the other side, none.
How could Chuck Schumer not know this at this point? I just don't understand.
I'm sure he knows it. I just don't think he's a deaf enough politician to do anything about it. It would take a Lyndon Johnson at the top of his game to find a way out of this situation the Democrats in the Senate find themselves in. And frankly, you know, that ain't Chuck Schumer. I think Nancy Pelosi in the House is a whole different thing. I still think she's got game left. I think she's slow walking, you know, the accountability factor, and that's a kind of a discussion. But I think she can. I think she's still got some tricks up her sleeve that she hasn't seen yet. I think there was a good reason why she was reelected. She was reelected to be Speaker when they took the House over. Ultimately, the country has to have a budget. I mean, and this was a way to do it. There is a political argument to be made for kicking this can down the road past the election. There are consequences to that, and we've talked about all of them. And I think probably those consequences are a little bit more inevitable than the people making them are, than people making the compromises think they are. But, I mean, ultimately, the country has to be governed, and one party has decided not to do that, even though it has the presidency and the Senate and increasingly the courts. So, it's a very hard situation to be in. I think Nancy Pelosi has got more game in this regard than Chuck Schumer did. She was a brilliant minority leader in an impossible situation, which is what they need in the Senate right now.
All right. I will grant you that in the past she was good. Right now, the best thing I can say about Nancy Pelosi is that Chuck Schumer is horrible. And I think we saw a notion of this. You know, people wonder why is she slow walking immigration. I happen to think she doesn't want to do it. Then the question is why?
No, you mean impeachment.
Impeachment. People are wondering. I happen to think she doesn't want to do it. Then the question is why? Well, I think the immigration bill may give us a little bit of understanding, right? Because the immigration bill, she had one that was basically requiring ICE to do all sorts of reporting. It went to the Senate, and Mitch McConnell brought up another bill, ignored Nancy Pelosi's bill, brought up another one, and I don't know, 80% of the Democratic caucus voted for that bill. So it comes back to the House with, I don't know, something like 80 to 19, 81 to 19. I'm not sure what the count was, but it was clear that a lot of Democrats had defected at that point. How can Nancy Pelosi not pass that bill? You've got all these Democratic senators voting for it. I think Chuck Schumer stabbed her in the back in that situation, and I think she's afraid that if she brings up impeachment, not that the Republicans won't vote for it, of course they won't. I think she's afraid that she's going to lose 15 Democrats in the Senate because Chuck Schumer is such an incompetent fool that it's going to really increase the exposure for her Democratic congresspeople. What do you say about that?
I think you're right, but I also think there's an even simpler answer. I don't think she's got 215 votes in the House. I've increasingly become convinced that she doesn't have the votes in the House to pass an article of impeachment. That there will be, believe it or not, enough Democrats to defect on that question to ensure that it never gets to the Senate, and that would be a whopping disaster.
Right.
I mean, I don't think the bill, passing the articles of impeachment, having a trial fail in the Senate is that big of a political loser.
No, I think it's a winner. I think you make the case to the American public, and you say the Republicans are standing in between accountability and the American public.
That's exactly right. But losing the vote in the House, where you have the majority, would be disastrous.
I agree.
And I mean, she counts better than I do, and I think she, honest to God, I mean, people are, go around saying, well, she's protecting, the Abigail Spanbergers and all the other people who voted, who were elected in districts that flipped in 2018. That's only a very small part of it. I honestly believe she doesn't think she has 215 votes.
Wow.
She may be close. I mean, she may think she, they've only got 109 committed now.
Right.
In what should be easy.
Right.
And some of the people, in safe seats, like Catherine Clark in Massachusetts, they're only getting around to supporting it this week after Mueller. So, were I a member of the House of Representatives, would I be in favor of impeaching the president? Absolutely. But we don't, come hell or high water. But I think we can all agree that putting up articles of impeachment out of the Judiciary Committee and then having them fail in the General House would be awful. I mean, that would just be the worst possible scenario.
I agree with that.
And I think that's what she's afraid of.
Well, I guess.
And as I said, she counts a lot better than I do. And maybe she's right. But I mean, increasingly, I think you've got a lot of people in the House saying, what the hell do we care at this point? I mean, things have gotten so, so bad.
Right.
That, I think there are a lot more people willing to take a chance now than before.
Well,
Jerry Nadler right now looks like he's ready to take an axe to things.
Yep. Well, Charlie,
I think a lot of that had. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. We're out of time, but I appreciate interesting perspective on this. I guess time will tell. Charlie Pierce, thanks so much for your time today.
As long as the heat keeps on, then things will develop, I think, in the way you want it. But, like I said, it's still a long road.
From your mouth to God's ears. Thanks, Charlie.
Okay, my friend.
Charles P. Pierce is the author of 4 books, most recently Idiot America. And he's been working as a journalist since 1976. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.
I had a dream about a burning house. You were stuck inside. I couldn't get you out. I laid beside you and pulled you close.
Hey folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You gotta check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.